Hi, good morning, everyone, and welcome. Thank you very much for all coming. So my name is Sherry Hills, and I'm the manager of research and strategic planning at the OMDC. And it's my pleasure to welcome you to the first of three breakfasts we have planned for Toronto here at Arcadian Court. OMDC is an economic development agency of the Government of Ontario, and our mandate is to build Ontario's creative economy, which includes the book, film, interactive digital media, magazine, music, and television industries. Our digital dialogue breakfast brings together people from different creative media industries to discuss topics that are of interest across the industries. We're hoping that this morning you'll meet some new people and reconnect with people you haven't seen for a while and get some useful takeaways. If you're interested in OMDC research, we're going to be producing a quarterly research bulletin, which will be emailed to subscribers. You can subscribe for research or any other industry news at OMDC's website on the About Us page. This morning's topic is Endgame, Leveraging Research Conclusions and Recommendations into Action and Implementation Plans. Research professionals working in the creative industries understand that some research is intended to find a wider audience. That careful crafting of methodologies and diligent research can lead to insightful conclusions. Results may be released in ways that further engage the audience. The panel today will discuss strategies for ensuring valuable research conclusions and recommendations do not remain on the page, but are disseminated and measured through effective visualization, action, and implementation plans. We're pleased today to have research consultant Lisa Freeman here to moderate our panel today. Our industry panelists are Janelle Bechtold, board member and chair of Women's Composer Advisory Council for the Screen Composer Guild of Canada, Krista Dickinson, president and CEO, Interactive Ontario, Emily Kellogg, program manager, Association of Canadian Publishers, and Melanie Rutledge, director, government and industry engagement for Magazines Canada. And now to our moderator, Lisa. In addition to her current role as the Executive Director of the Canadian Private Copying Collective, Lisa has a private practice providing research, strategic planning, and program and project management to clients in the cultural industries. Lisa previously spent a year as Acting Manager of Research, Strategic Planning, and IT at OMDC, and prior to that, she spent 11 years as a consultant with Paul Audley and Associates Limited, where she provided research, analysis, and support of strategic directions of government and industry organizations in the areas of copyright, music and sound recording, broadcasting, publishing, and film. Please join me in welcoming Lisa Freeman. Thanks.
I don't actually know how to turn these on. Hello, everybody. Thanks for introducing us, Sherry. I am hoping to engage in a great discussion with everyone here who's got some great research on the table and some new or long experience with launching research and actionalizing the findings. So without further ado, what I'm going to suggest is that each of you please just do a quick introduction of yourself and of the studies that you will be talking about today that you've just recently completed. So we'll just go this way. If Janelle, you want to start.
Sure. So my name is Janelle Bechtold, and I'm board member for the Screen Composers Guild. So the Screen Composers Guild is a professional organization that represents composers and producers of music for screen-based media. We do a lot of advocacy work both for the industry and also to basically promote the craft and the expertise of our members. The research that we have been embarking on is a gender study. It's called Gender in the Screen Composing or the Canadian Screen Composing Industry, and it's pretty well the first of its kind in our sector. In 2013, we did a baseline study where we found, we were basically just looking at the professional activities of composers and what the industry meant for composers, what our working conditions were, and we had four female respondents. So we realized that there was obviously an issue, so I developed the Women Composer Advisory Council to start looking at some of these things. So I'll be speaking a little bit more about that later.
Hi, I'm Krista Dickinson. I'm the president and CEO of Interactive Ontario. Interactive Ontario is a not-for-profit, nonpartisan trade association meant to foster the growth of the interactive digital media sector in the province. So we do that by educating, connecting, and advocating on behalf of our members as well as the industry at large. Most recently, in the past 2 years, we have released two pieces of research. The first one was done by Nordicity, and it's Measuring Success, MSIIDMO. It's a long acronym, so we just call it Measuring Success. It is an economics impact study for the digital media sector across the province. It's the first of its kind as well. One of the findings from it was the fact that there are 20% of the companies in IDM in Ontario who employ zero women, an alarming stat. That led us to say that, you know, well, clearly we suck in that area, but, you know, to be fair, I think a lot of sectors do. So we immediately thought, well, there's no point in actually doing a bigger dive in that as much as educating to try and improve and help the industry provide tools and suggestions on how to improve in that area. So we worked in, and hired Kelly Lynn Ashton Consulting to do the next piece, which was a report and toolkit that we rolled out on diversity and inclusion. So I'll talk a bit about all these pieces later. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Emily Kellogg from the Association of Canadian Publishers. I'm the program manager there. The Association of Canadian Publishers, we represent independently owned Canadian book publishers. So the particular study that I'll talk about today is sort of an exploration of the education market. So looking at the way in which K through 12 and post-secondary schools are acquiring digital materials and using them in classrooms.
Hi, everybody. It's great to be here. My name is Melanie Rutledge, and I'm the Director of Government and Industry Engagement at Magazines Canada. Magazines Canada is a national trade association. We advocate on behalf of our members. We offer member services, including professional development, strategic planning, governance. But as probably everybody knows, the vast majority of magazine publishing activity happens in the province of Ontario. So it goes without saying that we are particularly active here. And are a great partner. I'm very happy to partner with the OMDC. The research I'll be speaking about today is a feasibility study for a paid internship program for magazines in the province of Ontario. I would like to take a moment, though, to acknowledge Sharon McCauley, who's in the room today, of Sharon McCauley Consulting. I want everybody to know that Sharon did all the hard work and carried out this research for Magazines Canada. I'm here talking about it this morning, but I need to give credit where credit is due, and Sharon deserves all of it. So props to Sharon. It's great working with you.
Thank you, guys. So I wanted to just take a few minutes as well to talk about your research planning. So you clearly each had a reason to initiate the research that you did, but that's just the beginning. You need to decide how to do it, who to hire, and how to then get buy-in once you've established what your methodology is. You may even go ahead and lay some groundwork with your audience, the intended target audience for your research in the early stages. So would anyone like to start us off talking about that groundwork and planning at the outset of your research?
Yeah, I could definitely jump in.
Sure. I was going to say, Janelle, I know that you had an advisory board, for example, that
participated. So as soon as we realized that we wanted to start talking about composing and about gender and being female composers, we realized that we didn't have any information. So part of what we were looking for is a way to sort of just open up dialogue and discussion and start to really be able to highlight composers who were women. But again, if we didn't know any of the statistics, like we didn't know how many women there were, we didn't know sort of what types of projects women were working on, we didn't know, you know, if there was, like where exactly the disparity was happening. So we realized that we needed to put together a council to be able to talk about these sorts of things and to be able to figure out as well how the Guild can best advocate for women. And so we spoke to quite a number of organizations. We talked to people like Women in Music, who had just finished a study, as well as looking internally at our own organization, especially coming off the baseline study. And we realized that that the OMDC would be a perfect partner for this because a good portion of our composers live in Ontario. We brought on some industry partners as well. We brought on SOCAN, because they're probably the largest music organization in Canada, and they would be able to help us with a headcount. And to also, we worked very closely with them to be able to disseminate a survey to our to all audiovisual members in Canada. We also brought on Circum, so that was Benoit, and Lisa also worked on our study as well. So we broke it out into a couple different different avenues. We did a review of literature that was already existing. There's been quite a number of gender studies, and a lot of them don't talk about composers. And even organizations like WIFT, they didn't include women composers as part of their survey results or their study results because there were too few of us. So in addition to using this previous research, SOCAN's data, we also did a survey as well of composers, and we wanted to look at both men's responses and women's responses and see where the difference lies. We also did account for anyone who identified with either or, like either gender or in another open category, and we found that it was pretty well a dual sort of gender scenario that we were really looking at. I just wanted to make sure that gets out there, because it's not like we were just looking at men or women. We were looking at all gender. What we found was actually really quite surprising. Can I talk about that yet, or
maybe we'll talk about that perhaps in the next set of questions where we get more into the actionalizing, because
sure.
I'm sure everyone had some surprising findings, and many of you will have had experience with that. And what do we do with those? So yeah,
right.
Definitely worth talking about.
Right. So basically, just our process was really to be able to start the conversation. And there's been some really interesting sort of ideas for advocacy that have come out of our findings. So we'll chat about that later.
Stay tuned.
So I think more on the process part for the economic impact study, measuring success, that was years in the making. It's a huge undertaking for a not-for-profit organization, and socializing it with partners like the OMDC, the budget was significant. At the end of the day, the project is close to $100,000 all in, all aspects of it, because it's not just the study, there's the other components that go with it, and I'll talk to that piece a little later. So really socializing it ahead of time, getting buy-in, understanding the importance, the timing of it, and, you know, one partner will help land the next partner. So, you know, in our case, for instance, that'd be CMF. We also had some corporate sponsorship, which was critical, and we put our own money into it. So I think really it's about budgeting partners, and also big part of the process is not just saying we're putting it on the shoulders of the firm that we used, in this case, Nordicity, but working and collaborating together. We had a lot of tweaking we had to do, and there was patience, to be perfectly frank, on both sides. It was a true partnership, and there was things that we had to adapt along the way, and a few surprises. So one of the biggest surprises was from the onset, the amount of work on establishing the size of the universe. So really eyes wide open on, you know, what you're embarking on.
Yeah, I don't think that I can talk about the methodology of this research without immediately talking about some of the challenges, because this survey or this research kind of came out of research that we'd done back in 2012 that was initially looking at the way that educational acquisition was changing with the emergence of more digital resources being used in the classroom. So back in 2012, we had, our researchers at the time had identified learning management systems as being an area that could be emerging for the way that content was delivered in the classroom. So a learning management system is something, it's just an online module where online courses, online learning is happening. So it's something like D2L, or Blackboard is what we used in university. But it quickly became clear when we were working on this study that LMS was only a very, very small part of a much larger digital landscape. So we pretty immediately had to make it a larger study in order to really understand the market and understand what was happening with digital content in the educational sector. So to that end, we hired two consultants who were working as a team, Brian O'Donnell and Susan Howell. And they were kind of, there was one on each coast, side of the coast. Okay. Susan was over in BC and Brian was here. What we were looking for was kind of a united policy about digital acquisition, which we did not find. So instead what we found, again, very, very early on, is that policies for digital acquisition and the way that digital content is being used in the classroom varies from province to province, district to district, school to school. And so because of that, with our methodology, while, of course, the first step is to look at existing literature, but there really was none, the second step was to go to conferences where educators were gathered. But then the third step, and the thing that we really ended up doing, was just interviews, hundreds of interviews with educators all over the country. And because of that, it was really, it was almost like a big journalism project where they were knocking on doors, they were calling people, and it's a very labor-intensive method of research, but it was really the only way to get a good picture of what's happening in schools across Canada.
So Sharon carried out this research between fall of 2016 and spring of 2017. However, it's fair to say that inside at the association, we had been having internal discussions about the need and the value of a paid internship program for the magazine sector for years prior to even embarking on this research. And I think this is an important point. Having an idea of where you want to go, having conversations about it internally, of what your roadmap, of where you want to end up, what your objective is, disseminating that information and comms out to your membership in order to begin the process of buy-in, and having your members come back to you and say, you know what, this is really important. We're invested in this process. We're invested in the outcomes of this research. So when I say we have been having internal conversations about the need for a paid internship program for young people who wanted to build a career in the dynamic magazine sector, we did the research in 2017. I think our conversations dated back to 2013. So 3-4 years of speaking amongst ourselves inside the association, speaking with our board of directors, speaking with our members, with allied stakeholders, speaking with young Ontarians in the province who were, you know, interested in career pathways in that particular sector. We had observed the existence of two groups in this situation. On the one hand, we had our publishers, who were thinking about succession planning, obviously, and also about how to attract new, diverse, skilled, digital-first talent to their magazines. And on the other hand, we had potential interns, young people in the province of Ontario who were interested in building careers in magazine media and who were also a demographic that had been underemployed traditionally and also, you know, quite strikingly so in the last recent years, and who would benefit from paid work experience, from the opportunity to work with a mentor, and from the chance to build that all-important network of industry contacts. So we have our two groups here. We knew that they could be of tremendous benefit to each other, but for one reason or another, they weren't really talking to each other, right? And there were reasons for this. Publishers love the idea of paid internships, but cost is a significant barrier. And in general, we found that there was a lack of awareness among students and young people just entering the job market about potential career pathways in magazine media. So we decided that we wanted to build a bridge between publishers on the one hand and interns on the other. And this was the objective of Sharon's research. The bridge, once completed, would be in the form of a paid internship program for the magazine sector in the province of Ontario. Sharon's research was fundamental here because it helped us build the business case and the rationale for the program. The research was the beginning of this bridge building between publishers and interns.
That's actually a great example of having a very concrete idea of where you need to get to and why you need the research. And in some respects, that's a very fortunate position to be in. And no doubt you did have some surprising findings along the way. But we don't necessarily all at this table or in this room have a lot of experience with taking what you found and getting and using it, actionalizing it, figuring out how to, first of all, disseminate the findings so that the people who should have that information get it, that it's in a form that is digestible, comprehensible, engaging in appropriate ways. And so that's a first step, perhaps. But then the ideal, in many cases, is that you are going to be able to develop something to serve your constituents. And so that can require many different skill sets and different stages, perhaps, of rolling things out and moving things forward. As I say, we were fortunate to have a range of industries, a range of sectors, and a range of experience and roles in those processes for the studies that we're talking about today. So I would ask you each to describe for us what strategies and tactics you used in disseminating and operationalizing the research. So how organic was the process versus how strategic and pre-planned? How much was it responsive or reactive? How much was it proactive and sowing seeds for something? And then in some cases, I know you have planned or already engaged in setting up some concrete initiatives that were enabled by the research. So I don't mind if we go in order, if anyone wants to jump in and talk about how you received your research and how it was received by your target, how it was built on.
So the dissemination of the economic impact study was done very strategically, and I think that a few things is that our director of programs, Carly, she's in the audience somewhere. There she is. She's hiding. First of all, she really, really defended the amount of communications to our members because we wanted the survey to be properly filled out and that there wasn't noise and lost in that noise. But then she crafted, you know, press release, a launch event, and I think more importantly to me as the head of the organization, a tool that I use practically every day, and that is a video infographics of less than 2 minutes. It's exactly 1 minute and 50 seconds, and yes, that matters. After 2 minutes, you lose your audience. But it has all those really, really, really strong sound bites. You know, $1.4 billion towards GDP, 16,900 FTEs, you know, all those really, really clear pieces. So I have that as a link that I use constantly. I use it in inward investment meetings when companies are looking to set up offices in Toronto. Super, super, super important. And, you know, what I've found is that has become a calling card. But most importantly, we really took the material in there seriously. It has affected the topics that we are putting into our programs. We know now, you know, categorically that 80% of the revenues in our industry is coming from export. So we are really, really working on those relationships, that it be Colombia, France, Scotland, you name it, it, because we understand that that is all of a sudden going to grow our companies and then therefore grow the industry. Going back to that piece that I mentioned around gender, we all at Interactive Ontario, our partners and our staff and our board are very passionate about diversity. We're very passionate about making sure that marginalized communities have an opportunity to find job placements. So we've created a number of programs from both studies. One of them is an apprenticeship, and these are one-week placements within our member companies that are hosting either marginalized communities such as, you know, women, minority language. We are now working with the Black Youth Action Plan as an industry-led program. So really, really exciting pieces. The methodology and how we went around the diversity and inclusion program, because it is such a sensitive topic, Kelly Lynn was incredibly proactive at this was an in-person type of conversation versus a survey. So crafting the different communities and audiences that we had to meet with, and I can tell you, long conversations with Kelly Lynn about, you're missing the boat. There was a piece of the community that we haven't spoken to, and this is incredibly important. So I think that's a big part of what I wanted to share with you.
I feel like I can speak to this a bit. The Association of Canadian Publishers, our membership is publishers from all across. They publish textbooks, they publish trade books, they publish poetry. We really represent it all. So we have a really engaged membership that's really great in helping to drive these kinds of studies. So for this particular study, it really came from our education committee and our higher education committee. So our educational publishers were very, very interested in finding out just what was going on in our schools in terms of resource acquisition. It used to be that with the development of curriculums, there would be call for resources, call for materials from publishers, but that sort of communication has been less and less over the years. So Canadian publishers are less aware of what's happening, and as curriculum development is more decentralized, there's just less communication. So a lot of what we wanted out of this study was to just kind of build those bridges again and try and see how we could partner with the education sector to deliver quality Canadian content, because really that's our goal, to share quality Canadian content and have those opportunities. So I think for our membership, it was really important to just get an idea of what the marketplace actually looks like, because you would be surprised how, well, maybe you wouldn't, but I was perhaps a bit taken aback by how difficult it was to just get a clear view of what was going on. That's what I'll add for now. Is now the time to talk about concrete steps?
Absolutely.
Okay, yeah. Great. So what we ended up coming away with is we got this idea of this decentralization, fragmentation. As I had mentioned, every school is different. So we ended up with three recommendations from our researchers. The first one is to create a discovery tool of Canadian resources. The second one is to create a database of teacher resources. And the third one is to work with ministries of education to create sort of best practice guidelines for digital acquisition. The first two recommendations were very exciting for us because we have an initiative called 49th Shelf, which is a website and it's a database of Canadian authored books. It has original editorial content, and you can search if you ever are looking for any kind of Canadian authored book, it's on there. So we were able to really leverage that site and work that we'd already done to serve these recommendations, which is great. And so now we're working on 49th Shelf Kids, which is specifically geared towards children's books, and 49th Shelf Teachers. So 49th Shelf Teachers, and this is a partnership that we're doing with the Ontario Book Publishers Association organization. And so 49th Shelf Teachers is specifically geared towards teachers, and we're now creating that database of teacher resources, which is really great. And it's just the timing worked out, and we're really happy with that. In terms of creating best practices, it's something we're going to continue our outreach to ministries of education, and we're working on it. But it's always a challenge to form these partnerships.
Thanks, Emily. Maybe Melanie will give you a chance not to be last word on something. So.
Well, one of the strategies we used that worked really well for us in terms of disseminating the research when it was in course was that we actively and directly involved virtually all 343 of our members of the association. So we involved them directly in the process of carrying out the research, not only in Ontario, but we also surveyed our members clear across the country. Our methodology included really, really in-depth, like hour-plus long, there was somebody else who did long, phone interviews. So Sharon did really in-depth phone interviews with a representative cross-section of members based in Ontario. She really wanted to obviously have the Ontario publisher's viewpoint be uppermost. We also published an online survey with an invitation to participate sent to all Magazines Canada members. Obviously, we publicized the research through our regular communications channels at the association, so this included member bulletins, e-blasts, and we were continuously pushing it out on social media. I think importantly, the research was endorsed by our board of directors, and it's important to say by the OMDC as well. So I think a takeaway here is to find a way to actively involve your members directly in your research. They participate in it, and they help you carry it out. This is critical to building buy-in and success. In terms of how organic the process was, I feel like maybe a little bit of an outlier here because I don't think it was very organic at all. But that's simply because this had been a crying need in the industry for years and years and years, and I think we had been talking about it with each other ad nauseum. So everybody was like, "Yeah, yeah, yeah, just do it. Yeah, yeah, this is you know we really know what we have to do." So we just had to build a bridge to get there. So I would say that the research was actually pretty pre-planned and didn't deviate all that much from the plan we had envisioned. So a takeaway here, while I think that things often do evolve organically and there can be wonderful results when that happens, and I think that happens more often than not, it didn't happen in this case. I always default to planning, and I think it really does pay to plan and have a really solid idea of your objectives and your end goal before you embark on your research. And the other takeaway here, I mentioned that we were in we were speaking, having frequent conversations with our colleagues at the OMDC throughout the lead-up process to this. So I would say that it's really important to think about the mandates and objectives of your potential funding partners when you're in the planning stages of any research that you're considering. And remember, for funders, mandates don't really change, but strategic objectives can literally change overnight, like when a new minister comes in or when there's a change of government. So for the paid internship research, which led to the pilot program, this, you know, obviously you're looking at paid positions at magazines. This has a direct impact on the economy in Ontario because it creates jobs. And this is a critical part of the OMDC's mandate. So we think this helped us along a good distance with this research in particular, because we could easily make that link between our mandate and the OMDC's. In terms of concrete initiatives to come out of Sharon's research, well, we have a pilot paid internship program in the province. Sharon is managing it for us. What this concretely means is that there are 10 Ontario-based magazine publishers who have hired or are in the process of hiring 10 Ontario-based interns for 4-month paid full-time contracts. It's a 50-50 co-funding model, so the publisher is responsible for paying 50% of the intern's salaries and benefits for the 4-month contract, and Magazines Canada, thanks to the OMDC, pays the other 50%. I'll just also quickly say that we have big dreams for the concept of training and internships. I think Ontario was the natural best place for us to start this, but we are also very hopeful that we'll be able to launch this on a national level. And to that end, we're currently in discussions with Canadian Heritage about launching a national paid internship program for magazines. Two more things. I think this focus on internships really cemented for us at Magazines Canada our strategic focus on professional development as a key member service. It also embedded for us our focus on diversity, equity, and inclusion in all of our programming.
Which is a nice segue to Janelle, who is at a different stage in releasing the research and is learning, I think, a little bit about that process as you go through it.
Yeah, definitely. The Screen Composers Guild, this is our second research study, but it's my first as a sort of team lead. And so there was there's a huge learning curve, and I'm sure any small organization run mostly with the volunteers would be in a similar position. It's a lot of work. We did we looked at publicly funded productions and looked at all the funders, and you know, we're attaching composers to funding to projects, and that took hours and hours and hours more than I had ever expected. And then following up with companies and verifying information and stuff like that. So that was definitely a big learning curve, which sort of delayed our launch a little bit. But for us, the process was entirely organic. We didn't want to come up with our initiatives or advocacy or any steps before we figured out what the issue really was. And our research was fantastic for that, because not only did we find out that there's actually a lot more women composers than I knew about. There's 15% of the industry is female. But where the real challenges were identified were in hiring. The hiring practice itself, women are less likely to participate in direct targeted pitching activities. Instead, we're asked to participate in what's called a cattle call, where multiple composers are asked to submit music. Sometimes it's written specifically for the project, sometimes it's not, but you never have interaction with the client at that point. And it's usually, they don't really know what they want. They give you this long list of things that you're like, wow, that doesn't make any sense. and right there, because the limited interaction with clients, that means that already we're set up to not get hired. On the publicly funded productions, we discovered that 92% of the jobs were going to men, 5% were hiring female composers, and another 3% hired composers of mixed gender, so a team of composers. That wasn't surprising. What was surprising was that it had been consistent pretty well all across, like for the last 5 years. It was also interesting to know that women tend to do fairly well in theatrical. I think it was 88%, 22%. So that's actually pretty good. But in television, not so good. So from there, so when we're looking at things like hiring practices, and so we discovered that to advocate for our members, we really need to start looking at why women aren't necessarily being hired in these areas. And so that's part of our advocacy plan moving forward, is how do we get composers to be known by the people who are being hired? And so, or who are doing the hiring. And so we've made connections with a lot of organizations, things like Women in View, Women on Screen, Women in the Director's Chair, almost all the national organizations also now have women councils or committees that we've connected with as well. And now we're starting to look at other partners, production companies, the Guild of Music Supervisors, and just, you know, the CMPA for producers, the Directors Guild for directors, and really try and put people together in the room so that it's no longer going to be a case of this sort of faceless hiring process. And so that then as a guild too, looking at resources that we can put forward that will help people find composers. We're putting together to actually launch the study. We've been putting together some infographics and some other content that that is digital, that's easily shareable, that's easy to look at the numbers.
Terrific. Thank you. There's still lots to talk about. So with the help of OMDC's elves, I think we're ready to ask the rest of you if you have any questions for our panel. So if you do have a question, put your hand up, please, and wait for a microphone to come to you.
Hi, I'm Barbara Hosen from House of Anansi. This is a question for Melanie. With your internship program, why you didn't talk about any of the programs, the educational programs, and internship through the educational programs. So can you speak to a little bit about working with, I think there's a magazine program at Humber and things like that?
Yep, sure. Yes, absolutely. Thanks for that question. While Sharon did obviously spend a lot of time serving our members and speaking with our members, another important group that she did speak with was schools and educational institutions. Really we just wanted to, I guess there were a couple of reasons. One was to help the schools get the word out about the program down the road. Also really to augment, I guess, what the schools were already doing in terms of placing interns with magazines as part of the programs that they were already offering. Yeah.
Hi, I'm wondering if any of you are willing to speak directly about your experiences getting institutional buy-in and explaining to your boards or your other members about why you need to do this research from the get-go.
I'm happy to answer that one. So we have ongoing relationships with the institutions, that be OMDC, CMF, and we talk constantly about the topics that we think are most critical. So diversity, economic impacts, talent, recruitment. So those are kind of like our hot topics, financing. And we always have a very open dialogue on, which one actually fits into their strategy most at what time. And it can vary year to year. One of the things I did want to share to you, and it answers the board piece of your question, is Interactive Ontario has an annual strategic offsite in January. And we always bring in a facilitator to just get, the dialogue going, keep us on track. And this year's facilitator, in preparing for it, asked me, what keeps you up at night? And I said, bar none, it is actually how the hell do we get the next economic impact study done? And it wasn't on the books for this year. And I said, listen to myself answer this question. My job, therefore, is to move mountains and to bring this forward by a year. So, and really getting support from the board and explaining this to them, having help from the executive and explain that, everything has a shelf life. So does a study. So, investing on the next study that goes in tandem with that actually only augments and makes it more powerful. So you have to really keep that in mind.
Diane Davey, Work and Culture, and that's a huge point, Krista. How do we build repeatability into these things? We're about to launch on a fairly major survey, and I wanted to circle back around about the whole concept of survey fatigue and ask if any of you incentivized people, and if so, how did that work? What was it? How did that work?
Anyone?
No.
All right, so I think incentivize is the wrong word, and I don't mean to hog the microphone, but I'm going to. I think that really making sure that impressing on, in our case, our members, the importance and why we're doing this. What we're doing this time is we're not incentivizing the members, but I'm really, and Carly and my team and the board are working with our partners in communities to make sure that it's on them to bring in the companies from Hamilton, from London. So it's not quite incentivizing, but it's showing them what the benefit is to them. What I would say is the reverse, is not to compromise the research because someone's incentivizing you. And I have, you know, so if you have a corporate sponsor who may want to attach themselves, be very, very, very careful and weigh the value of those dollars you're receiving.
I may also jump in as well on that, in that for our study, we didn't tell anyone it was a gender study. We just said that we were learning more about the industry and the makeup of the industry and the working conditions of composers. And it wasn't until the end when we asked, you know, for people's gender, just so that we can make the comparisons. That was really it. So we didn't want people to answer the questions differently, knowing it was a study on gender.
I'll just jump in and say for the Magazines Canada study, there was a token incentive. The respondents who completed the survey had the opportunity then to enter into a draw for a two-day Magnet Pass, which is the annual magazine conference. And that it was just enough, I think, to appeal to people, but it wasn't over the top. And The main thrust of it was that we really are looking for your valued opinion and input into this feasibility study. And the generosity of the respondents in their write-in comments were incredible.
Just a comment on that, more of an answer too. I'm Margaret McGuffin with the Canadian Music Publishers Association, and I've worked with Lisa on three studies in the last 2 years. And two of them were pulling together statistics on our industry. It hadn't been successfully done in 12 years. The last time we had solid stats was from Heritage Canada 12 years ago when I worked with Paul Audley and Associates to do it. And so when we tried to do it 2 years ago, one, board buy-in was very important, but two, Lisa and Benoit tested the survey with publishers, because when it had been tried previously in the 5 years before that, they were getting questions that they just couldn't answer. It didn't match their business. So testing the questionnaire is so important.
Could I just say, we're very fortunate, and this wasn't planned, that most of the researchers are actually in the audience, except for ACP. So can I do a little shout out? So Christian and Julie are here from Nordicity, and Kelly Lynn. And Sharon are all here. If you want to just give a little wave, yes. You know, it might be a little business opportunity.
Oh, bigger
and
wave
Lisa herself, of course. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Any other questions from the audience? Because I'm sure everyone's still got interesting things to say. I would ask if anyone else, for instance, has any other tips on any particular state, any key learning on how to design, how to implement, how to launch, and how to get to your next stages. Or anyone in the audience, for that matter.
Emily, I loved your point about how the recommendations linked so well to your two recommendations linked to the 49th shelf. Mm-hmm. I just wondered if you guys could talk a little bit more about how to turn findings and recommendations into action, whether a positive or a challenge, if you felt like you had a finding but you didn't know where to begin, what you could do with it. Maybe you had to set it aside or something else?
Yeah, that's a great question. One thing, I forget who on the panel said it, but I will echo it, that it's really important to us to engage with our membership, because a lot, the study provided so much information, and we really wouldn't be able to distill it into action steps if we didn't have the expertise of the publishers and sort of the energy behind it. Because again, the Association of Canadian Publishers, we're a small organization. So all of our activities, it's wonderful when they're supported by this kind of volunteer work by our membership. And so in that vein, I think that communication with those who the information is kind of intended for is so important. So it was communication at every stage with our membership as much as possible. So we had our researchers come in and present to our entire membership twice, where they could directly speak with all of our members. And we had a lot of conversations with smaller groups with our different committees. And then we also had a meeting of just stakeholders. So we had a meeting with the researchers and with 49th Shelf, with our program manager at 49th Shelf, where we could really talk about it. And so I think it's that engagement with all interested parties and all stakeholders that are really able to take big ideas, big information, and distill it into action items.
I'd like to just make a quick comment. I'm over here. I've been teaching for the first time at a university in cinema studies, and I was horrified at how little, in fact, they knew nothing about the industries that they are moving into, and these are fourth-year graduating students. So I really think it's important that many of these initiatives reach out to the colleges and universities, because these graduating students are not connected to the industries that they are about to enter, and they need. If you want them, you're going to have to go out and reach out to them.
That's a two-way street.
I have a couple, colleges that reach out to me every year to speak. And surprisingly, then, those are the colleges and universities who end up having better connection with IO. There's no question that, most of us are not-for-profit trade associations that may have two employees, maybe a handful, and there's 36 colleges and universities in Ontario alone. It's hard to communicate to that many. Mm-hmm. So if interested, send invites. We'll go.
Hi. Oops, sorry. My name's Tracy. I have a question for Krista.
Ooh.
Talking more. I teach and I work in animation, and one of the things I question often, and a lot of it's VFX work, which yep. many of your members are part of, is the number of female department heads. And I'm wondering if there's been any studies into that, and the inclusion and diversity of department heads within animation and VFX studios.
So I know that CAESO, which is the association that encapsulates VFX and animation, they are doing a study right now. I don't know if they're looking at that exact data point, but I think Christian can answer the question.
Surprise! So not directly, but the answer is like not a lot. So the important part, Krista touched on an important part of the answer, which is that often the delineation between industries isn't super obvious.
Yeah.
So finding who is doing the research is the first good step. So in this case, it's not IO, it's CAESO, the Computer Animation Studios of Ontario, for those who don't know. And if you are a computer animation studio in your inbox this morning, you will find an invitation to fill out a survey. Do that right now.
Awesome.
We aren't capturing gender particularly, because I think, as many of our panelists may want to elaborate upon, if you want to get into a study that's going to be used for gender advocacy, you probably want to go through it with your eyes open, like particularly looking at that angle, or understanding what differences you might want to see. And if that's not the focus of your study, and it's probably not something you want to leave as a tack on the end. or else because, you know, I think like Kelly Lynn's work, Lisa and Janelle, their work is, you know, quite particular on that point. So no, but it should be. Short answer.
Do we have time for one last question, Sherry? Yeah, terrific. Jen, go
ahead. Hi. I used to work in radio. Jen Brown, I used to work at the OMDC in the research department, and I'm now doing independent research work. I wonder if some of the panelists could speak, whether it's involving the research you've just done or prior research. When you're applying for money from funders, sometimes you have a project, like with the case of Magazines Canada, where like you were saying, you know where you want to go and you're building a bridge to get there, but sometimes you're applying for money to research the unknown. So what kind of skills can you pass along to the other industry organizations when you don't have as much to say about the outcomes because you don't know what the outcomes are going to be? Do you know where I'm getting with that? Sometimes you have to admit that you're searching for answers to something and you don't know what those answers are yet, and you have to convince the funder that the study is worthy.
Go ahead.
Sure. I would just say in brief for us, I think it was about showing that what we don't know in general, it's very important to have as much information as possible in terms of exploring markets and assessing the state of the market. You know, you really don't know what outcomes you're going to get, except for the only outcome you do know is that you're going to know more than you knew before. And so it's proving that that's worthwhile.
Excellent question. I'm sorry, do we have time for one more, Sherry? We're out of time. Okay, in that case, I will thank everyone for excellent questions and for joining us today, and in particular, our lovely panelists. It's been a pleasure hearing about your experiences and learning from you. I'm hopeful that some of you may be able to stick around a little bit if you wanted to have another cup of coffee and meet the researchers or our panelists and ask any further questions and keep the conversation going. So thanks again to the OMDC.